All right, here we go. I'm Bob Garfield, and this is an OTM podcast extra. Actually, this week it's more of a bite-sized OTM with two stories that we can't fit into the full-sized show this weekend, but we just couldn't pass up digging into for you. What can we say? We live to serve. Those stories? War, peace, and clowns. First, on September 26 came historic news. After years of negotiations, the signing of a peace agreement between the Colombian government and leftist FARC rebels, who have been engaged in a bloody armed struggle terrorizing Colombia for the past 52 years. Then this weekend, an even more stunning development.
Voters in Colombia reject a landmark peace deal.
This deal, which took 4 years to negotiate and was widely expected to pass in a landslide, failed by the slimmest of margins.
Many voters said the deal was too lenient on the Marxist guerrillas.
How very Brexit, a nation of voters entrusted to determine their own fates, voting against their self-interest. The vote's been explained as the triumph of bitterness over common sense, but it may also be seen as a failure of media messaging. Alex Fatal is an assistant professor in the Department of Film, Video, and Media Studies at Penn State. He's studied the peace process in Colombia. Alex, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks. Wonderful to be here.
Much like Brexit, it was unexpected, but from even a short distance, it's not astonishing that the Colombian public voted as it did for a number of reasons, not the least of which, I gather, is it's really mad at FARC.
Well, you know, the FARC has been public enemy number 1 through 10 for the last 52 years. Wars, of course, include propaganda that helped to dehumanize one's enemy. You know, they recognize that they've been essentially outgunned in the propaganda war. The FARC is trying to represent themselves as humans, not as monsters to be hunted down in the jungle. So they have invited journalists to their camps to see how they live in their everyday life. They've been kind of on a charm offensive. Recently, they've started a news program out of Havana, Cuba, where they've been negotiating, and there's a directive not to have any guerrillas carrying arms.
Bienvenidos todos y todas a Nueva Colombia Noticias.
They're wearing civilian clothes. They look like presenters for CNN.
Hacia la construcción de la paz estable y duradera.
Well, the FARC's online news bulletin started out being called the Insurgent Bulletin. And then midway it changed to New Colombia News, a much softer title. And also changed its slogan. Originally the slogan was Breaking the Media Siege. And the second slogan was Informing for Peace.
There was a slogan that the FARC had, and let's just say it wasn't Make America Great Again or Yes, We Can. It was, and I quote, For National Reconciliation, Peace with Social Justice, and Advanced Democracy, which are laudable goals, but, you know, they don't necessarily trip off the tongue. Was everything about the pro-treaty communications as clunky and, you know, sort of uninspired?
That long-winded slogan that you just quoted was actually the slogan for its 10th guerrilla conference, which raises questions about who is advising the FARC in terms of their own media strategy. And my sense is they've been getting advice from essentially students in communication schools and sympathizers. And I think they're in this kind of iterative process of trial and error. But on the government side, they hired some very seasoned ad agencies, one of which produced a very slick campaign imagining what October 3rd, the day after the plebiscite, would look like.
Ella es Juliana. La guerra con las FARC acaba de terminar.
In which the C campaign or the S campaign won. And in that spot, you have this kind of very emotional scenery of a child being born, and it's a child who doesn't know any conflict in the country. And it's all very inspirational and kind of glossy. watching it the day after the plebiscite was like being in a parallel universe.
If the FARC is trying to build bridges to the left, there's an equal and opposite force trying to blow up the bridges before they're even built. And those are the Uribistas. Can you explain to me who they are?
The former president in Colombia, Álvaro Uribe, has a certain charisma that far eclipses that of the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, and certainly the current chief of the FARC, alias Timochenko. Uribe, of course, has been very adroit at creating the narrative that this is an everybody against the FARC conflict, and that this agreement was turning back the successes of debilitating the FARC and was giving them an open field to run wild in politics, tapping into patriotic notions that have been fed through decades of propaganda, but also feeding into kind of more conservative messages about family, about values. It was a mobilization of the kind of classic right-wing configuration in Colombia.
So Uribe was feeding the notion that the FARC had achieved through this treaty what it couldn't achieve through 52 years of guerrilla war and terrorism, and that they would enjoy impunity for all their past misdeeds. Is that what happened? The electorate decided that this was peace but with not enough honor?
Well, peace is the ultimate floating signifier. For Uribe, for a long time, peace meant violent pacification, hunting down the FARC. This notion that in some way you can kill the last insurgent was mobilizing his vision of peace for a long time. Now he's changing his tune, now that he's become a kingmaker after the plebiscite. I think the government and the FARC were counting on just making a basic argument of, you know, we've been at war for 60, 70 years, you know, even going back to before when the FARC was incorporated. You know, let's give peace a chance, and that argument would ultimately win the day.
The vast majority of Colombians have lived only during wartime.
Yeah, they're very familiar with the complexities of their own conflict. This is one of the conflicts in the world that's been most studied. And I think people understand that peace in some romantic ideal is not necessarily what's going to come after the accord. So the intelligentsia in Colombia has shifted from talking about a post-conflict period to talking a post-peace accord period.
While the results of the referendum aren't necessarily in and of themselves inexplicable, they very much differed from the polling that was done immediately before the vote, polling which suggested that C was going to easily prevail. Were people dishonest with pollsters, and if so, why?
Well, there's a lot of soul-searching in Colombia among the polling community and the media community who kind of bought into those polls because they were radically off. My own sense is that people didn't want to say or confess that they were against peace. There's a similar dynamic going on in the current election. You know, how could anybody not vote against this demagogue? Means that people who are on the fence or planning to vote for Trump are going to, you know, reserve their opinion and only express it at the ballot box.
Alex, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Alex Fatale is an assistant professor in the Department of Film, Video, and Media Studies at Penn State University. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Guerrilla Marketing, Capitalism, and Counterinsurgency in Colombia. The fall of 2016 will be remembered for many looming threats: terrorism, Trumpism, killer hurricanes, and maybe most chillingly of all, the clown situation. The clown situation is out of control.
Reported sightings of creepy clowns in a South Carolina town have some residents looking over their shoulders and even pulling out guns. People in the neighborhood say menacing clowns with flashing green laser lights have even tried to lure kids into the woods with large amounts of cash. Some have been so spooked they even opened fire into the woods, prompting police to boost patrols around town.
Yes, in Greenville, South Carolina, the cops have established a clown squad. On the hunt, according to the landlord of the apartment complex where the sightings occurred, for, quote, clowns or persons dressed like clowns. Anyway, that's where the panic began, but it has spread like cancer or grease paint.
Cracking down on clowns spotted in six central Ohio communities.
A group of girls told Annapolis police it happened on their walk to school. Monday morning, they spotted a creepy clown.
Plus, with Halloween on the way, scary clown sightings have communities on edge from South Jersey to New York.
Reports of creepy clown sightings caused mayhem at UMass Amherst and Penn State, too. Cell phone video shows hundreds of students running through campus trying to hunt down the clown.
The creepy clown sightings reported across the country are now hitting our region.
Clowns everywhere, taunting us in their big floppy shoes, chasing us, trying to lure our children into the woods, perhaps to abduct them, perhaps to honk bicycle horns and toss confetti from buckets. Either way, not funny at all.
The phenomenon that we've seen over the past month or so is a combination of two different things. The first one is stalker clowns, and these are people who dress up as clowns, usually teenagers, sometimes young adults. They're on darkened street corners. They're at parks at night. They don't actually harm anyone. They're just sort of standing around looking weird and strange out of place. The other type of clown is the phantom clowns.
Benjamin Radford, a research fellow with the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, is author of the book Bad Clowns. He says clown hysteria is a periodic phenomenon going back at least 35 years to the first so-called phantom clown sightings in Brookline, Massachusetts in 1981.
There were children who claimed that bands of clowns, often in white vans, were trying to lure and abduct them. And, of course, as you can imagine, this created lots of panic at the time among parents and school teachers and police.
And this has played out again and again over the years in various cities around the country. And I guess they tend to cluster, right? Such as this go-around when what started in Greenville has shown up in Ohio, in Philadelphia, you name it, all more or less with the same story. Children spotting clowns in the woods, claiming to have been lured towards the woods, and then parents and actual police getting involved.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It tends to be a cyclical thing. So in my book, I examine the history of these clown panics. And there were several reports in the 1980s. For a while, they were confined mostly to the United States. Then there were also reports in Great Britain. There was some in Honduras and elsewhere. And then they would fade away because when police actually investigated, they never found anyone.
No clown prints, no clown DNA, no grease paint on tree limbs or anything like that?
Not even a fingerprint on a rubber chicken.
Has anyone ascertained whether the kids are just making it up as sort of a prank or tall tale, doing it on purpose to alarm the adults, or are there cases of actual hallucinations?
So there's not one blanket explanation that covers everything, but essentially, you know, many of the reports that we know for a fact are hoaxes. There's been several children, in fact, even some adults more recently, who have confessed that they did not actually see a clown lurking around a playground or a park or something. They did it for attention. They did it maybe to get out of school. But in this case, of course, the subject is potential abductors. And that's why these stories are taken seriously in many places by schools and police.
And not for no reason. For example, John Wayne Gacy, the Chicago area serial killer.
John Gacy, a man who liked to put on a clown suit and entertain children. Now he is charged with one murder, and the police have found, at last count, 27 bodies buried under his house and garage, and two more in a nearby river.
Gacy's connection to clowns is slightly overblown. He did dress as a clown on occasion. He was actually a building contractor by trade. He wasn't a professional clown. And he didn't kill anyone as a clown, but he certainly promoted the idea of him as a killer clown after he was arrested.
When I got into clown makeup, I regressed into childhood. It was fun being a clown because you could be yourself or just let yourself go and act a fool.
But the notion of kids being at risk of adults luring them into danger is, I guess, omnipresent.
It is. And if you look back at it, it's certainly American history in general, there's always been this latent stranger danger fear. You saw this in the 1980s, not only with the clown panics, but also at the time, as you may recall, there was a satanic panic going on, fueled by people like Geraldo Rivera and others who told these lurid stories, these sensational accounts of Satanists trying to abduct children.
The Investigative News Group presents the Geraldo Rivera Special. Devil worship.
Whether a Satan exists is a matter of belief, but we are certain that Satanism exists. To some, it's a religion. To others, it's the practice of evil in the devil's name. It exists, and it's flourishing.
And then there were miscarriages of justice, the McMartin preschool case, for example.
These were staff of the McMartin preschool in California who'd been accused of sexual abuse and satanic rituals based entirely on the so-called recovered memory of children. A jury determined there was no proof of abuse.
And, you know, this is a good example of how rumors and fears can really take hold and take root in America. You know, we're in tumultuous times. There's lots of concern about who the next president might be, what he or she might do. There's actual terrorism. There are occasional school shootings. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me that the phantom clowns might resurface.
Now, there is real life free-floating anxiety, and then there's pretend. And it seems that a factor in this is Stephen King, his book It from 1986.
When people think about modern scary clowns in fiction, one of the big ones is, of course, Stephen King's Pennywise, with Tim Curry playing the evil clown.
Oh, come on, bucko. Don't you want a balloon?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers. My dad said so.
Very wise of your dad, Georgie. Very wise indeed.
For many people, certainly my generation Xers and older, they have this touchstone of this evil clown. For other people, it's Shakes the Clown, the Bobcat Goldthwait comedy.
I don't have a problem with my alcohol. I can stop anytime I want to. I just don't because I'm having a lot of fun with my drinking.
Oh, here we go. He puking my car. No big pieces.
Or Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
We've neglected to mention the Joker, who terrorized entire cities, in fact, the whole world.
Oh, absolutely. And the Joker is probably the world's best-known evil clown, you know, by far. You've got a DC Comics villain portrayed by Cesar Romero in the TV series, and most famously by Heath Ledger and Jack Nicholson, and more recently by Jared Leto in The Suicide Squad. If you're going to have a good hero, you need a good villain. That's the role that the Joker plays.
Kill you? What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, no. No. No, you. You complete me.
There was Homie the Clown, right, who was from In Living Color.
I don't think so. Homie don't play that.
And some of the reports in the 90s of the sort that we're seeing today were specifically of Homie the Clown in the woods trying to lure children to their doom.
That's right. It's fascinating when you look at it from a folkloric perspective and you sort of see the elements that people include in their stories and their legends, right? And so, for example, in the Greenville case, there was this fascinating element to it in which the children believed that behind these buildings, through this wooded area, through this lane, there was a house that was housing a bunch of evil clowns. And so you have this really interesting sort of Hansel and Gretel fairy tale aspect to it.
All right. You come to my next point, which is, with all due, I don't know, discredit to John Wayne Gacy and credit to Stephen King, the notion of clowns being just freaky, creepy, scary, chilling, bizarre, and disturbing goes way back past 1980.
The history of clowns goes back, in some cases, to, for example, the Harlequin, the figure from the Commedia dell'arte. You also have Mr. Punch, the star of the infamous Punch and Judy shows, which have been performed in London for 300 years. The wife-abusing, hook-nosed serial killer who throws his baby out the window, much to the delight of audiences across Europe.
Yeah, Punch throws a baby out the window and children laugh and cheer. Weird.
You have this blending of good and bad. You have evil and horror. You have scary and funny. You see that the clown has always been an ambiguous character. So this notion that clowns somehow turned bad recently, they were never really good. Never. In his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell says, "Universal is the casting of the antagonist, the representative of evil in the role of the clown. Devils, both lusty thickheads and the sharp, clever deceivers, are always clowns."
Because they were always grotesque in one way or another.
And what's happened is that in American culture, we sort of have this idea when we grew up, like, oh, clowns are, you know, colorful, happy characters. We see them in circuses. We see them in parties. And so we've sort of lost the historical and cultural knowledge about what the actual clown character was. And Stephen King played on this.
But our primal reaction remains?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean... Part of the reason that people find clowns scary is the mask, right? Because a mask will hide a person's emotions. There's always some question about what's the clown going to do. You never know, right? Is the clown going to pull out a seltzer bottle and squirt you? Is he going to stab you? Is he going to do a trick?
When you're an interviewer and you don't know even how to begin to wrap it up, the question you're obliged to ask is, what is the moral of this story? What are we to learn from Greenville, South Carolina, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Alabama, et al.?
There's a couple lessons. I think one of them is to keep in mind the dangers and consequences of these rumors and legends. There's wasted police resources. Much of what's going on is essentially copycats. One important lesson here is that you have to put these claims in context. Particularly for the news media, it's helpful to recognize that it's not just a single report of a clown allegedly menacing a child. There's folkloric aspects to it. There's cultural aspects to it. Put the issue in context and calm people's fears.
Ben, I appreciate it a great deal. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great talking to you.
Benjamin Radford is a research fellow with the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and a member of the American Folklore Society and the author of Bad Clowns. Oh, one more thing. Here's a little outtake from that interview. Hold on. I'm sorry. Hold on one second. Recording. Is everything all right?
Yeah, everything was
right.
Call me when you finish.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. We're talking clowns. How sorry can you be?
I guess I might have been a little short with my wife for phoning me during studio hours, but I did call her back right away. She just wanted to inform me that two of our local schools were on lockdown due to clown sightings. This has been an OTM Podcast Extra. And a reminder that if you like what we do, you can rate us on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. Please leave us glowing or even rapturous reviews. You might comment on our wit and transcendent humanity, but we're not going to put words in your mouth. They'll help other listeners discover us, and they will in turn come to love us too. It's a cycle. Thanks very much.